Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping. FBI's national security letters. State secrets privilege. TSA's 1 million plus no-fly list. Persecution of government whistleblowers. Perpetual wars. Rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. And today, we welcome back Joe Lauria, an independent reporter based at the United Nations in New York, whose work often appears in mainstream media outlets. Joe, as always, good to talk with you.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Sibel.
And we want to focus in the second portion of our conversation today on the civil war in Syria and the risk that this will become a regional war or perhaps even a more international conflict. But as we are speaking here on the 20th of May, there have been some very interesting developments just over the last few days related to Sibel Edmonds and coverage of some of the issues that she has raised since, of course, she left the FBI and became the most gagged woman in American history. All that is recounted in her book, Classified Woman. But recently, a British journalist, Dr. Nafees Ahmed, published a very interesting story at Ceasefire, and it says that a four-part series based on some of the information from Sibel Edmonds had been initiated by the Times of London, the Sunday Times, which is the upscale flagship of the Murdoch News Corp empire in the United Kingdom. And this was back in 2008, so this is not a terribly recent development. But we now know that what was intended to be a four-part series was curtailed after the second installment. And, Sibel, you must find it fascinating to see this sequence of events reopened and to discover that the third and fourth installments of the articles based on your information were what journalists call spiked. They were taken out of circulation and were not published. How did you react when you saw this story from Dr. Ahmed?
I was actually relieved, but also really disappointed to see it took 7 or 6 years or so for this extremely important report to come out. Initially, when I was working with the reporters at the Sunday Times, I mean, the reporters who were working on the story, this report, I mean, these were really, really good investigative journalists, something that I had given up on in the U.S. media. And I also want to emphasize that this story that they published and the others that they didn't get to publish because they were the story was killed by the State Department, actually the U.S. media was given the story together with some witnesses from government, former and current government officials here in the United States 3 years before that, in 2004 and 2005. And we are looking at, you know, places like New York Times. Think about Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists there, Washington Post, L.A. Times, and also McClatchy and their bureau chief in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. who actually got to meet with three different FBI officials, but then the story was never printed. And this was after a month of we were being told the story was going to come out in 2006, October and November. So finally, Sunday Times took this on and they were doing a very good job, the reporters. And lo and behold, the story stopped. All I was told, and this was off the record from by one of the insiders there, reporters, was that the editor for the paper had received pressure, first with calls and later meetings from the U.S. diplomatic community there, the State Department, I guess U.S. Embassy there, and also some U.K. officials saying that this is going to cause, or this was going to cause, diplomatic incidents. And he basically came and told the reporters that that was it, that they were no longer going to run the story and they were not going to run the other pieces that were already at work. Some of them may be prepared. And that was what I was told. But again, the reporters were still working for Sunday Times. And I could tell that they were extremely agitated and disappointed, and that's putting it mildly, with this abrupt killing of the story. And I had a pretty good idea, because the same kind of things has been happening to my case, to these facts, despite the fact that they are reported, I mean, they're supported by documents, by various government officials, current and former. I thought that this was going to happen through Sunday Times. Well, it didn't. So I was not surprised, but basically I gave up. I said, they can do it. Imagine if the U.S. government can pressure and kill the story in England, Sunday Times UK, how much they are doing here in the United States with mainstream or the quasi-alternatives. So that pretty much sums up my my reaction to this story.
Well, and Sibel, our listeners can go to your website, boilingfrogspost.com, and absorb all of this information. But to thumbnail it, it does add some new information to the elements that you have surfaced in the past related to the outsized role that Turkey has played in U.S. covert operations in various parts of the world, and the support for what we would call bin Ladens, plural, for various so-called terrorists who often are aligned with or on the payroll of the United States. And it also touches on some of the elements you have exposed of Project Gladio. And again, I reference people to boilingfrogspost.com because you've had a series of detailed video interviews with our colleague James Corbett. But to me, the work of Dr. Ahmed and this exposure of the Times of London and the spiking of the story has two critical elements. One is that the Times independently was able to verify many of your most serious claims, and you don't even know the sources whom they found who did provide corroboration. But that's a very important element to me. And secondly, it shows how much they fear the information that you have, that you have been trying to share with the media and, in turn, the American people.
Absolutely, Peter. First of all, I was really shocked. And this was the time, this is in 2007, 2008, I started gaining some long-lost optimism when I was told that there were at least three current and former high-level Pentagon insiders, officials, who had corroborated these operations, and this is U.S. covert operations together with Turkey in Central Asia and Caucasus with what today we call Al-Qaeda elements, and that is Ayman Zawahiri and bin Ladens, as you said, plural. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, orchestrating terror events against Russia using the Chechens, also some activities in Xinjiang area, but mainly in Central Asia and Caucasus. And the fact that they had three Pentagon officials and they had one senior MI6 intelligence officers who independently had corroborated and confirmed these operations. Now, I never was told who these sources were, because these reporters, of course, would not disclose their sources to me. But part of me was really relieved, saying I is no longer this one lone woman out there making these reports, making these allegations, But there are other insiders who want to see this information to come out, and they have given their confirming statements to a media outlet, which again, it happened in the United States, but it was never printed. Those stories were killed by these U.S. media outlets. So that is really big, and especially for me, because Peter, since 2002, when my case became public, with every single interview I had, and I think Joe can vouch for this because I knew George Joe Loria long before the Sunday Times article, that I would always tell the reporters, look, my state secrets privilege case, all this whole gag orders business has to do with our covert operations, black ops in Central Asia Caucasus and their links to 9/11. And nobody would print this. Nobody would film. Like with CBS 60 Minutes, my first exposure via U.S. TV networks, they had 1.5 hours of recording, and they, of course, aired 10, 12 minutes of that, and they chopped all that. Mm-hmm. So the media basically put their own spin on the story. This was about poor little translator who reported some wrongdoing, bureaucratic bunglings in the FBI, and then she was fired, and then government gagged her. Nobody would get into what I'd be telling. I know. So for some people who have been following my case only through the U.S. mainstream media, this is going to be like, wow, this is new. I mean, here now she comes and says this. But those people within the alternative media outlets, you know, who have been following this case, if people were to go and look at those documents, those interviews I've given since 2004, almost for 10 years, they would see and they would read and they would hear the fact that all along for the past 10 years, I've been emphasizing that my state secrets privilege had to do with the U.S. covert operations with Al-Qaeda all the way till 9/11, even a few months after 9/11, till February 2002, the U.S. government worked together with bin Laden's, with al-Zawahiri, with Al-Qaeda, now today called Al-Qaeda elements, in that region. And they orchestrated terror operations against Russia and to a certain degree in Xinjiang area against China.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, Joe Loria, what is your take on this? As a reporter who knows the Edmonds story quite well, and it turns out that you were a contributor to the reporting team that was working on this four-part series that was truncated to two.
Well, that's right. I was one of the three reporters on the story based here in the U.S. My reporting was in New York, in Washington. I went to rural Virginia to talk to one of the FBI agents that Sabell worked with, then out to Colorado to speak to another one, and Chicago, too. So the Sunday Times, surprisingly, sunk a lot of resources into this story until it got too close for comfort. And I've learned things from this article, too, that was just published, because I, not being based in London, but here, wasn't privy to what was going on. I'll tell you my side of the story. I did interview Sabell in her home, and that we started piece by piece putting the story together. And I think we were moving to that Central Asian angle that Sabell was talking about. And I think those were that was the next article that was planned, or at least we were moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And the story stopped suddenly. And I was never told why. I did not know that the Pentagon and MI6 people and American embassy officials had visited the Sunday Times office. I could just tell you that I interviewed three times in front of the house of an FBI agent who was involved in the case, who I can't name, in Colorado. And after the third time seeing him, I was called by my editor and told not to go back to his house, that the U.S. Embassy had called the Sunday Times and told me to stay away from his house, and that the FBI had told the embassy to do that. That was I did not know the story was killed at that point. I only knew that I couldn't go back to see him. I probably wasn't going to go back to see him anyway, because it was clear after three times he was not going to give me a lot of details at all. He wasn't speaking about it. He did make one remark, somewhat cryptic, but I took it as at least a semi-confirmation that Sabell's story was serious and that Sabell was not making stuff up. And that was when he said he was surprised that this story in the Sunday Times had not made news on the front pages of U.S. papers.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say that it was a scandal bigger than Watergate, which I have to say Nafis Mozik Ahmed's story says. I don't know where he got that from. But he did say that story should have been big news here, so I interpreted that to mean that this was a serious story. And yes, we were disappointed that the story ended. And we would have gotten deeper into Central Asia, which, of course, has become a big issue now after the Boston bombings and what the grid works that Bell has done on that, particularly with the uncle of one of the bombers, the older one, living in the house of Graham Fuller. And that whole story, which readers of Boiling Frogs Post can read about. I want to mention that I interviewed Graham Fuller myself once when I did an interview of Fethullah Gülen, the Turkish imam, one of the most powerful men mm-hmm. in Turkey. And Fuller was, of course, one of the guys who wrote a letter to the immigration vouching for him being able to have asylum in the U.S. So the Central Asian case, I think that's when they really did want. Obviously, now it looks like that was what really would bother them the most and why they thought they couldn't go there with the story. Up until the nuclear stuff, the drugs, it wasn't that specific. So I think that they were watching this story with alarm. But as we started moving closer to the Central Asian angle, they put an end to that. And as I said, that's a huge issue right now. And you have to see it in the context of the Cold War. Clearly, the United States has used, and Britain before that, has been in alliances with extremists, with Islamic extremist groups for a long time. They've felt comfortable using them for short-term basis. Sometimes it comes back to haunt them. 9/11 may be a very good example of that, where they used, of course, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to drive the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan and contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union. I must tell this story that I was on a plane in Iraq 2 months ago in March, I guess 3 months ago now, and I was speaking to a guy who he said he worked with the CIA for a while, and he's a kind of well-known guy. He's on TV a lot. I can't mention his name. And I believed him, and I brought this up to him that the U.S. using these Islamist groups that for a short time they have common enemies like Afghanistan and Russia, and how risky that is, because this led to 9/11. And I didn't even mention that. I just said this was a risky alliance, and he immediately said it was 9/11 was worth it. We had to bring down the Soviet Union. So before I even brought up 9/11, this guy did. So clearly, there's an admission there that this continued relationship of the West with Islamist groups, we see it still in Chechnya, we see it in Syria right now, we saw it in Libya, is a very, very risky policy of the United States. It's something that doesn't get any play in the mainstream media at all, and it's essential to understand the continuing Cold War in many ways in the Middle East and in Central Asia that Russia's losing right now, because they've lost Saddam, they've lost Gaddafi, they've lost, they're maybe going to lose Assad, although he's doing very well, as we'll talk about Syria later in the interview. This is an essential story, and Chechnya has arrived on the radar screen now because of the Boston bombing, but it's falling away. Nobody's examining that in the media, exactly what the relationship was between the United States and extremist groups across the region, in particular in Central Asia.
And Joe, given that you have read much of what Sibel has written and published at Boiling Frogs Post since April 15th, the bomb incident at the Boston Marathon, without trying to put any words in your mouth, just what are your impressions about the significance of the Chechen connection, the Tsarnaev brothers being almost immediately, you know, one could see it on a scripted basis. The photographs surface, the manhunt begins, the drama plays out on national TV. And there are so many questions that have surfaced. The role of Kraft International at the Boston Marathon scene, both before and after the explosions. There are a lot of significant questions about the backpacks, about whether this the government advanced theory about the pressure cookers loaded with gunpowder and projectiles, BBs, nails, whatever. There are a lot of unanswered questions about these events, but the official narrative appears to be signed, sealed, and delivered into the American media. And so one who raises questions about it is derided as a conspiracy theorist. And, you know, it creates this whole echo effect where legitimate investigations that attempt to really get to the truth are just immediately rejected as crackpots and people, you know, who are somehow off kilter. So that's a really long question, but please give me your thoughts about what we know and what we don't know.
Well, that's an indictment of the media right there, that they're afraid or unable to continue to ask those questions. And there's a lot of fishy things about this story. I don't know about Kraft and the backpack and all those details. I have nothing to say on that. But I was originally and immediately suspicious when the story kept changing. First, you know, the guy was shot, then he was run over by his brother, and then and now we hear there was a body maybe in a car, and they held up the 7-Eleven, then they didn't hold up the 7-Eleven. We don't know why that cop was shot. The MIT cop.
Right.
Then the New York police say that they were coming to party in Times Square. Next day they were coming to plant a bomb. I mean, either this is gross incompetence or they're trying to confuse the public. I really don't understand what exactly happened and why the story kept changing. That's number one. Number two, I think that the whole angle of the United States, again, what I was saying before and what Sabell was alluding to at the beginning, the relationship between the United States government and institutes and neocons with Central Asian extremists in the Caucasus in particular has not been brought up in this story in the mainstream press. And that again, is a large story of the last many years and decades, particularly since 9/11, but before that, going back to Afghanistan and before that, the relationship between the United States government and extremists and using terrorism, supporting terrorists for political ends, and Russia fighting against that, and the continuation of the Cold War. That part has not – this was a perfect opportunity for the press to start to look into that. Now that Chechnya went on the map of most of Americans who probably did not know where it was. Of course, we heard that ridiculous story that they thought they were from the Czech Republic. Just shows you how little the public knows about this, and that's the fault of the media to a great extent. And they have not looked into this. So you cannot dismiss stories that Tamerlan, the brother, the older brother, and I think the younger brother was just dragged along in this. And so he's alive, but I don't know what he knows about what his brother did when he went to Dagestan and Chechnya and apparently Georgia. But he went to this Jamestown Foundation meeting, which was started by Bill Casey, the CIA director. His uncle lived in the house of Graham Fuller. I mean, James Found Fun is recruiting young extremists. Clearly, this kid looked like he was a CIA asset. I mean, there's no absolute proof, but you have to look into that. There's just too many signs there, right there, that he is.
When Ruslan Sarny popped up in the news, even before I knew who his nephews were, and was denouncing them as losers and you know, giving us this kind of big puffed up pro-American spiel of his own. I mean, he struck me as a kind of Jack Ruby character in the Kennedy assassination. You know, who is this guy who runs a strip club, and why is he all of a sudden at the center of this, you know, controversial case? And so the injection of Ruslan Sarny just immediately set off bullshit detectors for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, he had to trash the guy because, look, if he was a CIA asset, I think there's three possibilities of what happened here. One, the official story could be true, that these were lone guys who were angry about, by their own statements, they were angry about American wars against Muslims. And that, by the way, corroborates with Peter Falk, if you know, who's a UN rapporteur on Palestine, who got into a lot of trouble again for writing an article, maybe too soon after the bombing, because obviously people had died there, and maybe a little too soon they brought the politics. But what he said was essentially true, and that this was a reaction to U.S. foreign policy. I mean, it's It's, remember, Ron Paul brought that up in one of the debates, and Giuliani blew a gasket, you know. He never heard such a thing, that 9/11 could have been a reaction to American foreign policy.
Well, so Jeremiah Wright, remember Reverend Wright? He said chickens are coming home to roost, and the right wing just went apoplectic about that.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, but here in the words of the bombers themselves, they did it for that reason. So that corroborates what Falk and others are saying. But that's, you know, that's just not going to register. So either these kids, this guy, Cameron, was a CIA asset, and or he was a lone bomber, as the official story says, and they did it completely on their own, which is possible. But he could, if he did that and he was a CIA asset, it could have been he turned on his masters, that he was angry. Could be he was a double agent for the Russians, because Russia would gain from this to back maybe the West off of Chechnya, as you sully Chechnya's name in the American public's mind. Or, you know, God forbid, the FBI has done about 20 or more of these phony terrorist plots that they have dreamed up, these sting operations, that they choose some dupes, they choose the target, and then they give them a fake bomb, and as they're about to plant the fake bomb, they make the arrests, and it looks like the FBI saved the day and disrupted a terrorist plot that they themselves created. And if you recall, once I spoke on your program about a synagogue underneath my window, where I lived in Riverdale in the Bronx, where this had happened. And I went there to the press conference, and I tried to ask Ray Kelly, who was there, the police chief, if this was sting operation, and he wouldn't answer my question. But afterward, privately, I spoke to the FBI director of New York, who explained to me that they sent an informant up to this town in upstate New York, and they had him wear sandals so he could attract Muslims, and they plotted the entire thing. Now, in Italy, talking about Gladio, in Italy in the 70s and into the 80s, there were various bombs that went off, one in Bologna that killed about 80 people at the train station, and then in a bank in Milano, where about 39 people, I believe, were killed, that it later came out in court and was proven was done by elements of the Italian government using extreme right-wingers to try to blame it on the Red Brigades, a left-wing militant group in Italy that was assassinating people but had never been proven to have bombed innocent people. They were assassinating economists and people in government, and they had, of course, kidnapped Aldo Moro, the Italian prime minister, the former prime minister. But I mean, God forbid the CIA this time really did use a real bomb. I don't believe that. I don't want to believe that. But I think that's only possibilities we're seeing here, that they were lone wolves, that there's a CIA asset turned against the CIA. That was four possibilities, that they were working for the Russians. It was a double agent. Or four, that it was a real it was an inside false flag job by the CIA. Now, as far as the FBI knowing and the CIA knowing these kids for 3, 4, 5 years. They were both on their terrorist list. They had interviewed them at home. Why did they put the picture on TV saying that the public had to get involved to identify them? They knew clearly who these guys were. Whether they were working with them or not, whether they had just been watching them, they knew who they were. And then, of course, what we saw happen when the police marching innocent people out of their houses with their hands over their heads, locking down an entire city for a wounded 19-year-old kid, was just very, very disturbing. So I think the story has gone away now, and we'll never really find out, unfortunately, what exactly happened there.
And Joe, you mentioned one of many possibilities there is this idea of a so-called false flag event. And I, for one, am open to that possibility. I think that if you are intellectually honest, that you have to examine all possibilities, even those that would lead to, you know, a very unpleasant set of issues that our government may have somehow been involved. But what strikes me as so odd is that we have the rich fictional universe that people live in of the Bourne fantasies and the 24 TV show and all of these movies that people watch that, you know, often include theories like a false flag event. Yet when it comes to reality and when it comes to the world we live in and the way it's reported on by the mainstream media in this country, we are not even permitted to consider an option or a scenario like that. It is immediately dismissed, and those who stray outside the lines and don't keep their crayons inside the lines are demonized.
Yes, I was nervous just saying that on your program right now. as a possibility, which I'm just saying is a possibility. I really don't know that, and I don't want to believe that we've come to that in the United States. If they did do that, you have to think of what the motives are, and I can't think of too many. Maybe Sabella has some ideas on this, except that people have gotten complacent about the so-called terrorist threat, which is completely trumped up, which is needed to continue this permanent war, which we now saw last week in Congress, the debate over extending that authorization of military force. They're going to go on another 10, 20 years, and the battleground is everywhere from Boston to wherever in the Middle East or anywhere in the world.
I'm glad Joe, I'm glad you raised that, because yeah. I was about to, and in the intro to this show, we hear Sibel Edmonds talk about perpetual war. And we just got the tip-off in that testimony that the Obama administration does not want any modification to the blank check that was passed after 9/11, the so-called authorization for use of military force, and that they are planning to leave us in this permanent state of war for another decade or two. It is mind-boggling. That story was buried in the New York Times, and I haven't seen it picked up anywhere since.
Yeah, Greg Greenwald, of course, who's consistently writing great columns in The Guardian, did a very good piece on that. And, you know, apparently it came up in the hearing that they don't even know who they're fighting, who the enemy is. They have to keep this going for the extension of their power and their wealth. That's what it's all about. And it's, we're a militarist country, we're an empire, and this war is central to that. And that's why I say that's the only reason I could think of that it would have been a false flag inside the U.S. here is to continue the popular support for these wars. But I don't want to believe that, and I don't because I have no evidence to think of that. But I do think it has to be put out as a possibility. But you're absolutely right. It's the press is completely chilled. You can't even raise that as a question. And it's a completely foreign idea to the American public. Even though you say just mentioned in popular TV programs, which is quite interesting. I was not aware of that. I don't watch too many. I don't watch any TV shows like that. I did not know that in popular shows they raise false flags. And why would they do that except that somebody's trying to maybe, since you can't directly raise that in the news media, maybe some TV writers want to raise it as a possibility in fictional programs. I just don't know about that.
Well, Claire Danes is starring in a new TV series. It's on HBO or one of the premium channels, and it's called Homeland. And it is complete with these kinds of threads. And again, you know, that is acceptable in fiction, but it's off limits in reality. Sibel?
You said that in this show, there are American, U.S. officials, U.S. government is involved in attacks on Americans?
I've only watched one episode of Homeland, and it did allude to something like that. So I'm not qualified in terms of my depth of exposure to that show, but that's what I picked up from it.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, that's all I can say.
Peter, I really like this sentence you use when you qualified it by saying, if you are intellectually honest. And I think that's the key, especially when we are dealing with this whole notion of false flag operations. I mean, when you sit down, 99.9% of the people, let's say if you were to sit them down and show them documentations, and these are, you know, official documentations that came out during trials in Italy on false flag operations that CIA and NATO carried for decades all over Europe, Eastern Europe. If you put before them all the historical documents showing the false flag operations, again, devised and orchestrated and implemented by the U.S. government, the CIA in Central America, you put all this stuff in front of them and say, okay, here are the characteristics of false flag that should be at least considered in cases like 9/11 or this Boston terror attack. Immediately you see this, head jerk and saying, no, they would never do it here. Our government would never do it here. I agree. I see it and I believe it that we have been doing it all over the world. Not that we did and it was over. We have been continuously doing this all over the world. However, they would never do it to us, okay? And it's that mentality which is intellectual dishonesty, okay? And this is just a form of denial. And you see, then you put them, in front of them, you put this Project New American Century, PNAC, okay, and say, The shadow government, the people who truly devise the things in this country, they said, we believe, and these are the neocons, neoliberals, they're on the same boats too, we believe, short of some huge event here, in homeland, here in the United States, we won't be able to implement our foreign policy objectives, which is imperialism all over the world. So here, the decision makers in this country, on the paper, they are putting it, the fact that, okay, these are our objectives for all around the world, but in order for it to happen, we need to have this massive event. We need, I'm going to emphasize the word, need to have this massive event here at home, okay? And of course, we know our CIA. And yet for us to say, yes, we've been doing it for decades all over the world, this is what the decision makers concluded, that we have this imperialistic foreign policies with the former Soviet Union being, you know, gone. This is what we want to do. And in order to do what we want to do, what we need to do, we need an event like this or events like this. See, you put all this before the Americans, the majority, And still, they give you this blank stare as if it's too much to digest, psychologically painful, emotionally painful. It's worse than even how people get to be biased about their own, you know, parents, their mothers and fathers. At least with those, we have people who come forward and say, well, you know, I'm screwed up because this is what they did. Sure, they were my parents, but they screwed me, right? But we put our government, or at least the majority, even above that, saying they, our government, even though run by psychopaths, even though we accept they are run by crooks and criminals, even though we know this is their modus operandi, they've been doing it all over the world, we have this false assurance, this sense of assurance that says they would never do it to us. Somehow they have put this as a no-no, our government, and won't dare venturing there. And that is the dishonest, this intellectual dishonesty that puts us here where we are today, with all the scandals, with all the cover-ups, with all the unanswered questions. That's one of the first things we need to overcome, and that is what you just said. And that is extremely important, Peter. You framed it very well. If you are intellectually honest, and as a nation, we are not there.
Yeah.
I want to add something about there's a tendency to look at the United States government as a monolithic force. I think Sabel's story and what I worked on the Sunday Times showed that there are often rogue elements within government or agencies or groups that might have their own agendas, and that the rest of government, including Congress and other parts of the administration, maybe the White House itself, would not know what they might be up to. So we have to look at that. If we're going to talk about this possibility and break that down and not show that necessarily the whole U.S. government may have been involved in something hideous like this. And again, I want to just emphasize again, I don't believe that. I don't have any evidence for that. But I think, you, as Peter says, if you want to be honest and really look at all the possibilities, that has to be laid out there. But I'm afraid it's just going to lay out there and never be investigated. So we'll never know what really happened in Boston.
Well, and this year we have the dubious 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, and we still don't have a clear understanding of those events. And was it rogue elements? Was it, you know, the mafia? Was it, you know, blowback over Kennedy's decision to try to get us out of Vietnam in the early 60s? You know, we have a lot of unresolved controversies and episodes in American history, and the tolerance of the American people for that often astounds me. And also, just not to demonize the media any further, but that these are big, juicy stories just waiting to be fully reported. And
it's career threatening to go after these stories. You just can't even raise these issues.
Yeah,
you can't raise that possibility. I would never do that with my editors at any of the mainstream papers. And I hope they're not listening to this interview, because I want to continue to work for them. But you know, in giving an interview to your site, I know that your readers are not unfamiliar with this concept. So I just say that, yes, if you're going to be honest, you have to look at every possibility. But I think one thing is certain. They acted, at least they say they acted against American wars against Muslims, and that's a broad term, But there's no question that with the drone program still going on, with the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, that Americans are killing Muslims, many, many innocent Muslim civilians. You know, John Kerry made an interesting statement the other day about Nigeria. The Nigerian government is massively undertaking a counterterrorism operation against Boko Haram in the north of Nigeria. And they're killing scores of people, rounding them up, killing. And there was a story in the New York Times that they don't know where to put all the bodies. They're rotting in the yard of the morgue because they can't fit them all in there. And these are people they're just killing indiscriminately right now to try to horrible extremist attacks in the north of Nigeria. But John Kerry said that the Nigerian government must be disciplined in their counterterrorism, and they can't be going after civilians and killing civilians. And I mean, that applies to the American war on terror as well. But it would never occur to him to apply that to Yemen, to Afghanistan, where drones and Pakistan are killing innocent civilians. So what he's calling on the Nigerian government to do, the U.S. government is not doing.
Well, Joe, let me take that expression of hypocrisy and shift to our promised discussion about Syria, because I've noted several media reports over the last week or so revealing that some of the opposition militants in the Syrian civil war apparently have been using torture. And like any kind of torture, I deplore that, and I consider it to be wrong. But I find it very interesting that this is being surfaced in the American media. I expect that it is intended to get the reaction of revulsion that people rightly should have when anyone uses torture. But silent from it is any reference to the U.S. adventures in torture, the celebration of torture in films like Zero Dark Thirty, and the common perception that torture has worked and has revealed information that either protected Americans or advanced our security interests. So let's shift to Syria now and talk about the nature of the conflict there, because it does appear to have shifted in recent weeks. It appears that the Assad government and the military of Syria have recaptured some critical areas, and they appear to be their momentum appears to be gaining on the Free Syrian Army and the array of foreign fighters, some of whom are unidentified, who are currently at war in Syria.
Absolutely. That might be one of the reasons why the United States got together with Russia to try to get a conference, because Assad is not losing, and he's starting to win. And the reason he's starting to win is because Hezbollah from Lebanon has joined the fight in a big way in Syria, and they are using asymmetrical warfare against asymmetrical warfare, guerrillas fighting guerrillas, and that's making a huge difference on the battlefield. And he's got a strategy of linking up towns from the south all the way through Damascus to the north to try to get Homs. They apparently have taken the city Qusair, which is between Homs and Damascus, and then to link it up with the Alawite heartland in Latakia. So there's no question that the Assad government is not only surviving, that they have still enormous loyalty of a huge part of the population and most of the military. And most of those defections are over now. We don't hear about them anymore. So in a sense, the people who are not loyal to the Assad army have been weeded out from the government's point of view. And there's a real change on the battlefield right now. And there have been a number of events, that being maybe the most prominent one, in the last couple of weeks that have really changed the character of the war, and again has led to an attempt at a peace conference, which I think is bound to fail. We can go into that later. And that is also the chemical weapons allegations on both sides, mm-hmm. which I don't think anybody should have said a word about, because I know that a senior Western official told me that they don't have concrete evidence of this. They want an investigation. And then the UN side, Carlo Del Ponte, one of the investigators for the UN Human Rights Council Commission in Iraq, in Syria, claimed that the evidence looked like it was the rebels who used the chemical weapons, but they didn't have absolute evidence either. So we have both sides using statements that I think shouldn't even been made, because there's no evidence to back them up. Mm-hmm. There's the issue of Israel getting more involved with the airstrikes that they undertook. There's the bombing in Turkey.
Well, hold on a second. Yeah. I think the issue of Israel's there have now been three airstrikes by Israel, even into the metro area of Damascus, the capital of Syria. And Syria has now said, this is it. If there is another attack, and Israel is warning that there will be, and they have warned the Syrians not to retaliate, and Syria now says that they have trained surface-to-air missiles on Tel Aviv, and that if Israel does launch another attack, and Israel rationalizes this by saying that they are denying the transit of heavy weapons from Syria to Hezbollah, and Hezbollah moving them into Lebanon. All of this, to me, is very high stakes, risky behavior on the part of Israel, just essentially daring Syria to respond militarily.
I think Syria is bluffing, and I'm afraid Israel may call their bluff. And the reason I think Syria's government is bluffing is because the last thing they need is a massive retaliation from the Israelis in Syria, because they could do serious damage. However, they would have to do it from Lebanese airspace, which is an interesting point, because there was some good reporting recently showing that the Syrian air defenses are superior, and it would be risky to put a no-fly zone over Syria because of that. So Israel flew over Lebanese airspace to strike those targets inside Damascus. But I think even from Lebanese airspace, or shooting surface-to-surface rockets from Israel, they could do serious damage to Syria. So I think if Israel strikes again, I would be very surprised if the Syrians, especially now that they're gaining on the battlefield, I mean, if they were going down, then they might want to, they might not care and draw and attack Israel. But they're not going down, so I don't think that they would respond. And I think they look foolish if Israel hits them again or they don't do anything.
Now,
but I would be very surprised if they did.
Can you tell us more about the allegations from Israel that Syria is moving heavy weapons into the control of Hezbollah, and then those are being transited into Lebanon? Because it strikes me that Syria's got its hands full, and you just mentioned that Hezbollah has been actively fighting with, you know, on the side of the Syrian government against this array of rebel groups, and it strikes me that they don't have the bandwidth to be fighting in a manner that appears to be turning the tide of the war, at least at this moment, trying to furtively transfer weapons from Syria into Hezbollah control in Lebanon. I find that hard to believe.
Well, Hezbollah is not using those heavy weapons in Syria. They're fighting on the ground, as I said, in a guerrilla fashion. And those missiles that are supposedly going to Hezbollah are trained on Israel to protect Lebanon and Hezbollah's interest in southern Lebanon. They already have about 100,000 missiles. This comes from Dan Meridor, former Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, spoke at a last two weekends ago here in New York at an event I went to. Said they have 100,000 missiles trying there. So do they need more? Does Syria need those weapons more? I don't know. Iran is the one, and Russia apparently shipping them, and I think that they determine who the end user are. If it's from Russia, then I think they're intended, obviously, for the Syrian government. If they're from Iran, they are probably intended for Hezbollah. So I don't know. I mean, I really don't know where those weapons were intended to go. I think Israel, that's obviously their official statement, that's why they struck. But someone told me that they hit about 40 different sites on that last bombing. So it may have gone well beyond, someone who's informed, go well beyond just hitting those missiles. But they could be intended for Hezbollah. I mean, Robert Fisk brought up in an interview recently that he thinks the Syrian government would want to use those missiles themselves. So that's a real possibility. But I can't give you a definitive answer where those weapons were going and whether the official Israeli story is correct or not. But again, I would be surprised if Syria responds to their threat by hitting Israel.
Sibel?
I'm just trying to think of any fake pretext that we haven't really used. I mean, if you look at what's been happening, you know, it started with Assad being abusive and carrying semi-genocide against his people. Then from there, we went to this chemical weapons shenanigans. And you see how quickly that disappeared? I mean, it was headlines, front page, and nobody's coming and debunking it because it was actually debunked, okay? But you don't see the mainstream media carrying it. And that was done a la Iraq, WMD. And then we had this now latest bomb in Turkey, that Turkey started saying, yeah, this, we know we have suspects. We know that the Syrian government did this, and that is crossing our red line. And if U.S. doesn't respond, we're going to go in there and respond. And then you have Israel coming and saying, yes, now these weapons through Hezbollah, they are doing this. I mean, you look at it, it's back to back. And even when there are most of them, or if not all of them, are being debunked, you don't see the, you know, any kind of a reportage from that aspect of follow-ups, which basically, I think, points out to one thing. We want this guy gone. We want our puppet regime installed there. We actually want to, in a way, partition Iraq, Syria, as it's happening right now with Iraq, with Kurdistan region and with the Shias and Sunnis. In fact, I mean, the civil war is full-blown, is in effect right now in Iraq. We want similar thing for Syria, and we have our mind set. And you keep saying it, so it's going to be U.S.'s red line with the chemical weapons, Turkey's red line with the bombing in Turkey territory, Turkey's own territory, with Israel's red line with the weapons getting into the hands of the terrorists and Hezbollah and getting into their side. So it is really unending, but it also shows that we are, and this is our government, is set. I mean, they already have the eyes set on Syria, and it's going to happen. And the only obstacles really in the way has been Russia. And even with that, to a certain degree, we have already began seeing some softening. And that is, you know, with the meetings between Kerry and Putin in a couple of weeks ago, it already boiled down that Assad is going to be gone, okay? So having the talk and putting a transition government, this is already by both parties, and that includes Putin. Russia is the fact that everybody has already decided that Assad is gone. It's just going to be how we're going to put the transition government and install our, you know, puppet regime afterwards. But the fact that even Russia right now is saying, you know, because initially they said, well, Syria has to be part of this open table discussion that we are going to have possibly in Geneva. But later that started changing, that, well, maybe Syrian government, Assad government, is not legitimate enough to sit on this table. And U.S. and Kerry, they came and they said, no way they're going to have Assad sitting on the table. And with all the transitional government discussion floating around, it seems to me that even with Russia's obstacle, the issue of Assad is going to be gone has already been settled. Or at least this is what it appears like. And what is your take on this, Joe?
Well, the Russians for a long time have been saying that they're not attached to personalities, so that they don't even like Assad. I've heard the Russian ambassador to the UN say that. But what they don't want to see is an ally, one more ally, fall in the region, and this continuation of the Cold War in the Middle East. As I said, they've lost. Blow to Russia that they supported the no-fly zone, because they bought the argument that that was going to be just to stop a threatened attack on Benghazi by Gaddafi. That this brings us to the question of humanitarian intervention, so-called responsibility to protect, that they were only going to stop this attack. But in fact, the NATO no-fly zone was air cover for the rebels to overthrow Gaddafi. So they're not going to allow that to happen in Syria again. They don't want to see Russia, an Islamist government, coming to power in Syria. They want to keep a secular government that's friendly to Russia in power. Whether Assad himself is the leader of that or not is immaterial to Russia. But so therefore, you're right in saying that Assad could go, but they don't want to see it replaced by a Muslim Brotherhood government, even a moderate one, or certainly by some more extreme Islamist forces, because once they come to power, we know these guys are moving around the region, and they could easily get to Chechnya and reignite the war there. It's a 24-hour drive from Aleppo to Chechnya, and so they just don't want to see more encroachment. This goes back again, ties up what we were talking about Central Asia, with the West backing Islamist extremists and the Gulf. We cannot leave out the Saudi and Qatari involvement in this. Russia doesn't want to see Syria fall to Islamists. And the United States, too, having created these Frankensteins, realized that they wouldn't like to see necessarily an al-Nusra front-type government in Syria either. So I think that's why we saw the U.S. and Russia coming together for this planned conference next month in Geneva that already is failing, and even if it takes place, cannot succeed for a number of reasons. And I think leaving Iran out of the conference right now is one of the big sticking points. Russia wants them in. The United States and the West doesn't want Iran there. And I think Iran has to be there. And I spoke to a very senior American official about this 2 weeks ago, and she told me privately that Iran was not going to be there. And I said, well, they're a major player, and she agreed to that. But they can't go. Now, you have to have Iran at that conference. Everybody's got to call the dogs off in this war. The West, the Qataris, the Saudis, the Iranians, if we want to see an end to this conflict. The other reason why I won't succeed is because right now Assad is doing well on the battlefield. And, you know, he might get a better deal at Geneva, but the rebels, you know, are not likely. Are they ready to give up? I don't think so. So the issue is here, will the West continue to push for regime change in Syria? They're saying they are, even if a wrong type of government comes into power. I have no doubt that the Qataris and the Saudis will continue to push for that. They're the major motives in this, because they do want to see it as a religious-dominated government in Syria. Every imperial power wants a government in place that reflects their own system. And the United States and the West would like to see a neoliberal government reform that depends on the IMF, that privatizes all of Syrian businesses, to sell off very cheaply the best assets to Western investors, impoverish Syrian people by throwing them out of work and saddling the country with debt and cutting back on social safety net. This is the same model applied everywhere the West gets involved. It's the a neoliberal system that the Western press does not examine. It goes unexamined because they're part of it. It's a neoliberal press, and they don't even understand. The reporters I work with, I don't think they even understand what this is. They just think they buy the rhetoric that it's democracy that's being spread there and that there's freedom. And, of course, the freedom that the West is talking about is free trade and privatization of companies. That's free elections, which are stage-managed, as they are here in the United States to a great extent. I mean, so again, we're going to export an American type of democracy to these countries, which is not real democracy. So the people of Syria have these terrible, and all across the Middle East region, have a terrible choice between a secular dictatorship like the Assad government is. It's a police state. It was very repressive, but it tolerated minorities, Christians, women had more rights. And that's why he's still getting a lot of support. He also had good relations with Sunni businessmen. Syria is an independent country, independent in the sense of it forges its own policies. It's not part of the Western system. It's not part of the Gulf system. They have their own views, and it was a self-sufficient, more or less, economy as well before, and the West hates that. They want to drag them into the neoliberal system. The other choice is a religious dictatorship or this neoliberal system. So there are terrible choices that the Syrian people are faced with. And Russia and the United States are trying to prevent this war, I think, from becoming a region-wide conflict. You alluded to the Iraqi war, civil war being reignited already. Lebanon is fighting in Tripoli every day now between Sunni and Shia. The influx of the refugees into Lebanon is changing this demographic balance and the very, 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 very fragile balance of the three confessions in Lebanon. So you could see a war between Sunni and Shia spreading from the Mediterranean all the way to the Tigris River in Iraq, and all these fires joining together in one big conflagration. And that could be ultimately in the interest, depending on who wins, of the Sunni extremists if they could win. And the United States is on that side. And, of course, the destruction of these Arab lands and all the lucrative contracts that can mean in rebuilding. And we've seen today, I want to mention that Wesley Clark and a very shady Bahraini investor are announcing in Beverly Hills today that they're starting a fund to rebuild Syria after Assad. Well, A, Assad may not go, but B, that shows you what the program is in the West, to get in there and to start rebuilding the country along the lines of the Western neoliberal model. And if you recall, Hillary Clinton once called Assad a reformer and a good guy because he started to make some liberalization of the economy, which was to the liking of the West. That was about three or four, 5 years ago. So that's what they want. They thought Assad was doing that, but he really didn't go far enough. So what happens in Syria now, the worst case scenario is a region-wide devastating war that could then involve Iran and, you know, could involve a strike on their nuclear facilities as well. And that would be just absolutely a horrendous war that would take decades to rebuild, but maybe something the West and the Gulf would like if they win.
Mm-hmm. Joe, one final question. You've made a couple of allusions to Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And recently we've seen that they're kind of in a competition to see who can provide greater resources, in particular cash, to the so-called rebels in Syria. So their interest is exposed. We have a pretty good idea of Russia's role in this, not so much to prop up Assad, but to protect its interests in the region. We have a good sense of Iran and Hezbollah's involvement. But what strikes me is that, you know, we have this knee-jerk reaction that if an embattled dictator says something, it can't possibly be true. And I think of the fact that Saddam Hussein gave his last Western interview to Dan Rather and said Iraq does not have any active WMDs. Turned out he was telling the truth at that point. And so Assad gave an interview to a Latin American newspaper, I think it was Argentina, last week. And in it, he repeated some of his charges that there are foreign terrorists who are trying to bring down his government. And that is at least partly true. Yet we're not allowed to really see that reported in Western corporate media because it conflicts with the official narrative. So tell me your thoughts about this this conflict of factors that leads people to automatically assume that because Assad is a brutal dictator, that he is not occasionally telling the truth.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, with Saddam, he turned over a huge dossier that proved that he had destroyed all the WMD, and it was ignored at the time. But, I mean, that was the case at the beginning of the war in Syria, that they Western media trashed the idea there were terrorists there. But that's not the case anymore. The United States has put the al-Nusra Front on the terrorism list.
Mm-hmm.
The State Department has admitted that there are terrorists operating in Syria trying to overthrow Assad, and they're on the same side as the United States, but they don't want to arm the rebels because they're afraid weapons can get into their hands. Well, you know, The Economist, by the way, just published a list of the 9 principal fighting groups in Syria. All of them are Islamists of one stripe or another, some moderate, some more extreme, like al-Nusra, which has about only 6,000 fighters, but they're the best fighters, and they are doing the most damage against the government. But now they're being confronted by Hezbollah. The Saudi-Qatari rivalry for dominance in the region is spread everywhere. It was in Libya, it was in Yemen, it's in Mali, and it's in Syria. And in general terms, the Muslim Brotherhood is the recipient of help from the Qataris and more Salafist groups from the Saudis. And the al-Nusra Front may be funded by Saudi princes or the Saudi citizens, not officially by the state, although it's with a wink and a nod that the Saudi government allows this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So they are fighting, and this goes back to the overthrow of the Emir of Qatar by his son in 1997, and the Emir's father was on vacation in Switzerland, and he took over the country and didn't let his father back into the country until just a few years ago, and his supporters are in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis is always talking the Qatari in circles that they are to mount a counter coup to put his father's people back on the throne in Qatar. So that is part of the rivalry there, but it's just about who is going to dominate the region more. And the Qataris, this small country nobody pays any attention to, is emerging as a hugely regional imperial force. And they got their fingers everywhere. They're friends with everyone and potentially enemies with everyone. They're friends with Hamas. They have good relations with Israel. They really don't have good relations with Russia, though, I have to say. The guy who was in charge of the mastermind of the theater terrorism attack in Moscow,
mm-hmm.
which was one of the worst and really most terrible and frightening events that we've seen, along with Beslan, the kindergarten,
right.
went to live in Doha, in the capital of Qatar. He was protected there until the Russian security forces blew up his car and killed him. So we've got the Qataris supporting openly terrorists, the Saudis doing that, and they're trying to overthrow Syria. I can tell you, I was in Doha in December talking to a senior, well, not very senior, but a government official in Qatar. I was involved in all kinds of private businesses, too. Government and private is very mixed in this country. Mm-hmm. And he said to me under his breath, I've got to get into Syria. I mean, we got into Libya. We got to get into Syria with his business projects. So, I mean, they are eyeing Syria as a big, big prize. And the Saudis are eyeing Syria as a big, big prize. And the neoliberal West is eyeing Syria as a big, big prize. And ultimately, the Syrian people are caught in the middle of all of this. There was genuine disaffection of Syrians against this autocratic regime of the Assads. I remember I was in Damascus about 2 weeks before the uprising began in March 2011. I was walking around, and every 5 minutes you saw a picture of Assad and his father. There were always pictures, statues everywhere. And I was thinking the equivalent in the U.S. would be walking around New York and seeing a picture of Bush and his father for the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I would want to rip those pictures down, or even a Democratic leader that had been there for 40 years. So there was genuine hatred of this regime. But it's been hijacked by these outside interests. And the Syrian people are suffering because of this. And right now it looks like, will Assad win this? Will he be able to crush this rebellion, at least in the west of the country, the heartland of Syria? And will the Gulf and the West give up then and allow him to win? I don't think so. But how do they then help the rebels by overthrowing Assad at that point? We're at a very, very crucial point in this war that will probably go on, unfortunately, for a long time.
Yeah. Joe Lauria, thank you very much for joining us today. I always learn a lot talking with you, and I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Sibel.
On us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.